You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been quite a news week for the aviation industry. On Monday, we learned about Steven Slater's escapade. He's the JetBlue flight attendant who slid down the escape slide after getting into an argument with an angry passenger. And then former Senator Ted Stevens died in a small plane crash in a remote area in Alaska. Joining me today to talk about fed-up flight attendants, tiny planes, airport security, and many other topics is Patrick Smith, a veteran pilot whose column Ask the Pilot appears regularly on Salon. I added an M there. I guess a little piece there. Salon.com. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Is this the first time anybody's called it Salam.com?
Well, usually they call it Slate.com. So.
In writing about the JetBlue incident, you referred to Steven Slater, talking about Slate, Steven Slater as an instant folk hero, a D.B. Cooper of the Peanuts and Pretzel set. Do you think that the story speaks to a growing dissatisfaction with flying in general, both on the part of passengers and airline staff?
I think it definitely does. And, you know, to be clear, I can't condone what Steven Slater did. It was hysterical, irrational, really.
And dangerous.
Not to mention illegal and dangerous. But at the same time, he did become kind of an instant folk hero. And this segues into a couple things. The first is the phenomenon of air rage, quote unquote. Why do some people just seem to lose their minds in and around planes? And we're talking about passengers here. And to what extent is this the inevitable result of all the pressures and hassles and indignities of flying? At the same time, it highlights the pressures that overworked, underpaid flight attendants have to deal with. I mean, a flight attendant's primary job on paper, of course, is the passenger's safety. We all know that. But in practice, you know, what is it that flight attendants do? They oversee and supervise a large group of agitated, uncomfortable people. And that just can't be good, and these sorts of things are just bound to happen.
Although their chores have become a lot less, they no longer have to deliver meals. They no longer have to do a number of other things that they were expected to do in the past. But I've always wondered about this whole business of the plane landing and people getting up despite being asked not to. They stand up right away. They get their bags. And then what do? They can't leave any quicker because there are usually people in front of them who have not stood up and who are just listening to the instructions of the flight attendant.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. And, you know, I see it as something in our culture now, just kind of this reaction against authority. And it's especially poignant in the airline environment because people just don't like flying. And right or wrong, they don't trust airlines. And there's this kind of built-in hostility there that makes it easier for some people to fly off the handle or just become belligerent.
Now, why do you think they don't like flying? In the past, there were those people who had a fear of flying, but most people kind of enjoyed it. Is because of the fact that so many of us wind up sitting for several hours on a runway?
You know, Leonard, I'm old enough to remember when people used to break out in applause every time the plane landed and clap, and I mean, because it was still kind of a novelty. It was something exciting and different. You know, that's gone, but you know, I have to say this, and you know, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but people have come to have a certain sense of entitlement, I think, when flying. You know, airfares today are really the lowest they've been in 30 years. I mean, over the past quarter century or so, fares have been coming down, down, down. It costs about as much to fly now as it did in about 1985. You can fly across the country, really across the world, for pennies per mile in almost absolute safety. And meanwhile, there are more planes flying to more places than ever before. You can go anywhere, pretty much any time, for you know a very low fare in almost perfect safety. And to some extent, we've built this unsustainable system because these things are to some extent mutually exclusive. And the system is logistically stressed, it's financially stressed, but this is what passengers want, what they've come to expect. And whenever the system kind of buckles or lurches a little bit under this stress and doesn't function as smoothly as we'd like, people start screaming.
Well, it used to feel special. Now we have limited services. We're being asked to pay for checking and baggage, and there's even an airline that's charging people for carry-on luggage.
Right. You know, I say to that, well, if you want to fly from New York to Chicago for $49, you know, you can't expect a whole lot. And carriers have come to what they call airfare unbundling now, where it's kind of an a la carte pricing. This much for your seat, this much for a bag, this much for another bag. In some ways, that's a good idea because it allows some passengers to take advantage of certain things that not everybody wants, and it spreads out the fare and keeps it affordable for everybody. On the other hand, you know, it's a slippery slope, and people feel nickel and dimed. And, you know, when you start charging for carry-ons and check bags, you know, that kind of that's not fair because people at that point have no choice. You're obviously going to have one or the other.
Many are blaming deregulation as the cause of all of these problems.
Yeah, I hear that a lot. You know, that goes back to 1978, 79. You know, how much of that has kind of come out of deregulation and, you know, this industry culture change? I don't know. Probably a lot of it. But there are other things in play here, too.
Well, I've had my own run-ins. One day I came home to pick up my luggage before I took a flight to Long Beach, and there was a message on my phone telling me that my flight had been canceled. Nothing else, just that my flight had been canceled. So after a lot of work, I found the number that I had to call to get through to JetBlue, and then they told me that, well, it was they said it was weather, but of course there was a flight to Los Angeles. There was another one to San Diego. So I assumed that it was because they just didn't have enough people on that plane, booked for that plane. They made no attempt to help me get there. And eventually I wound up on a flight to San Diego with me paying all of the extra fares that were necessary to get me from San Diego to Whittier, which was my ultimate destination. And that kind of thing, after another run-in with JetBlue because of that terrible problem they had where they just didn't work out their assignments and a lot of flights were canceled, well, that made me worry about JetBlue, but I don't think that they're the only one that's having these kinds of problems.
Well, for all the things the airlines do well, they tend to be very poor communicators. Getting the message out to customers, whatever that message happens to be. And I think what you just described is an example of that. You know, there's an idea out there that airlines lie to people, consciously lie and deceive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've worked for several carriers over the better part of 20 years. And, you know, I can tell you that that really is not a policy. Instead, what happens is communication breaks down as it's transferred from department to department. Airlines are very compartmentalized, and each compartment tends to have its own vernacular, its own set of priorities, and so on. And as information goes down the chain, it's kind of like that game of telephone where you send a message around the room. By the time it gets to the other end over the speaker at the gate, it's garbled, and a lot of times the person delivering the message doesn't understand it themselves.
How much of this is because today most of us book our flights through the Internet? There was a time when we either went to the travel agent or we called the airline itself, and things tended to be worked out.
Well, it's that. It's also that airlines are very big. You know, 800 million people fly in this country every year, is some 2 million odd a day. And you've got, you know, a given airline, I don't know, say American with, you know, 600 or so airplanes, each one making, you know, several flights a day. There are so many parts in motion and people transferring and moving. It's hard to keep track of. It's a great logistical challenge. And when things go bad, you know, they go bad.
My guest is Patrick Smith, whose column Ask the Pilot appears regularly on Salon.com. Well, we invite your calls, by the way, or you can leave comments on our show page at WNYC.org. Our phone number is 212-433-9692. Security has also frayed a lot of nerves. It's gotten, there have been tighter and tighter security measures. Now there are even the body scanners that the TSA plans to install in every airport. Currently, they're in some of the smaller airports like Columbus, Ohio. Do you think there might be an Al-Qaeda cell in the middle of Ohio?
Well, you never know, but TSA and airport security is something we could talk about all day. I feel that TSA's whole approach on the concourse, not so much what they do behind the scenes with baggage screening for explosives and whatnot, but what we see on the concourse there at the airport, the metal detectors, the X-ray machines, all of that needs to be completely overhauled. It's really reached a point of absurdity. And there are two fundamental flaws, I think, in the agency's approach. The first one is that it treats everybody who flies, from an elderly person in a wheelchair to an airline captain, as a potential terrorist. And in a country where 2 million people fly every day, that's just not sustainable. And the other fundamental flaw, which ties into that, is this fixation with the September 11th scheme. Here we are 10 years later, and we're still picking nail files and hobby knives out of people's luggage, which is preposterous, because even a little kid knows that you can make a knife, you can make a deadly sharp object out of anything, including no shortage of items that are found on an airplane. So why are we wasting time and resources rifling through people's bags for sharp objects that, when you really look at it, are harmless anyway, because the September 11th template from a terrorist point of view is really off the table at this point. When you go back to 911, what the terrorists took advantage of on that day wasn't at all a loophole in airport security. What weapons they had really didn't matter. It was about exploiting our mindset and our expectation of what a hijacking was. That's completely off the table now. And from a terrorist point of view, to try that sort of thing again has such a high likelihood of failure that I can't imagine they would try. The brilliance of the 9/11 plot is, so long as the guys didn't chicken out, it was guaranteed not to fail. It was going to work, and it did. That's completely different now.
Well, who are
And why we're so obsessed with that formula is mind-boggling, and it wastes millions of dollars and millions of hours.
Well, do you think that some of it is actually directed at making the passengers feel more secure?
Well, maybe it is, but that doesn't mean it's a good thing. If we're Americans and we're going to be proud citizens, we have to get above that. We don't need to be, infantilized by this government agency trying to make us feel good. Just do the right thing and keep us safe. Don't play games and play theater at the airport.
What about the full body scans? Have you ever gone through that?
I've been through them a couple of times. They're effective. But go back a few years. If you said to people that a few years from now, they're going to be like X-raying your clothes at the airport, looking at you naked. I mean, people would have said, no, that's impossible. And here we are. These things creep up on us. And, who knows what's next? Or maybe this is the end, body scans. I mean, what could be more intrusive than that? I don't know.
I have to wonder whether there won't be some security paparazzo who saves certain body scans, and we'll be seeing them in the magazines. This is here's a kind of a body scan nude picture of a movie star.
Right. Well, the promise was that the scans would not be kept, and already we're hearing reports that they are being kept. And meanwhile, overarching all of this is the fact that you're never going to stop air crimes completely. No matter what we put in place, there's always going to be a way for somebody who's resourceful enough to get around it. And, air piracy, bombings, all of this stuff has been with us for decades. We have this mindset now that crimes against airplanes didn't start until September 11th, 2001, and that's crazy. I mean, let's go back to the 1980s, when you had multiple commercial airliner bombings, Pan Am 103, Air India, UTA, two different TWA bombings, all in the space of, less than 10 years. There were attacks at airport terminals. There were multiple hijackings. Meanwhile, since 9/11, really almost nothing has happened. We're safer now than we've ever been, but we have this mindset of fear that leads us to think that we're less safe, and it's totally backwards.
My guest is Patrick Smith, who's a veteran pilot, whose column Ask the Pilot appears regularly on Salon.com. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We'll be back with more right after this. We're back with Patrick Smith, whose column Ask the Pilot appears regularly on Salon.com. Before we end with the security measures, or of course they'll come up again when we take some calls, I wonder, you've written about the radiation risks on full body scans. Is there going to be a problem there?
There's a lot that we just don't know about that. That remains to be seen. I don't know for sure that these scanners are going to remain in place at all. We'll see how this shakes out as opposition to them grows.
You've spent a lot of time in single-engine planes. You wrote in a column last month that you have almost 1,500 flight hours at the controls of various single-engine Cessnas, Beechcrafts, and Pipers. Are they like the ones that the one that Senator Stevens was in more likely to crash? Are they prone to crashes?
Well, I wouldn't say they're prone to crash, but they are less safe. Less safe is not the same as unsafe, but the risks are greater. Obviously, a private pilot doesn't undergo the same rigorous training that a commercial airline pilot does. The airplanes do not have the same redundancies and safeguards and technological gee whiz built into them. And flying in Alaska, particularly, can be very hazardous. So,
they talked about light rain clouds and gusty winds, but aren't those typical weather conditions?
Well, those things in and of themselves don't crash a plane, but a mistake a pilot might make in those conditions will. It's important to draw a line here and realize that the theater of general aviation, light plane flying, is vastly different from the realm of commercial flying. And without knowing too much about what happened in Alaska, maybe we should just leave it there.
Well, what about the smaller planes that the regional carriers use? We did a segment on the pilots who they hire. They usually have a lot fewer flight hours. Some of them get paid an incredibly small amount to fly us, and we assume that we're flying on Delta or American or United.
Yeah, great topic. A lot of people don't understand the relationship between the major carriers and these regional airline affiliates. To begin with, the airplanes themselves, they're small, but they're by no means quaint. In a lot of ways, these little RJs, regional jets, are more sophisticated than some of the bigger planes. Of course, an airplane is only as safe as the crew you've hired to fly it and trained to fly it, which, brings us to a whole other issue. There's a lot of controversy about the hiring practices at some of these regional carriers. With pay as low as it is at these airlines, they've found it harder and harder to attract and retain the most experienced crews. Over the past few years, some of these airlines were hiring pilots with as little as 300, 400 total hours. Now, the number of hours a pilot has in his or her logbook is not necessarily an indicator of how good a pilot they are, but, there are certain intangibles that somebody that green, that inexperienced, just doesn't have. Now, to their credit, these airlines realize this, and the bigger regionals, these Express and Connection carriers, have very good training departments, and they've gone out of their way to make sure that the pilots coming out the other end of the pipeline are qualified and as highly trained as they need to be. And I would caution people, we could make the argument that on some level regional carriers are not as safe as the big mainline carriers.
Well, they tend to have more crashes, don't they?
But that in no way translates to them being unsafe. And I'm not the least bit saying to people, don't fly on a regional airline. I'm not going there at all. But when we parse this out and we start to really dig down and then look at you know, the hiring trends and whatnot, you know, there is an issue there that could come into play long term.
Let's take a call. John from Paramus, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to know what's the status of cell phone use on airplanes. There was a proposal, I guess, a year or two ago, and it kind of died out. Is that a dead issue now? I hope so.
Well, you're hoping that people aren't allowed to use cell phones.
Yeah, I mean, the people on airlines are obnoxious enough with all the food now that they bring on and the luggage. I don't want them, and they're loud enough. I don't want them screaming on the phones.
I don't either. Most people don't. You know, there is a technical side to this where interference from phones, you know, can interfere with certain components on the airplane. I mean, I've heard lots of anecdotal stories about cell phone interference. There was an accident in Switzerland a number of years ago that was allegedly caused by a cell phone. Cell phones have been known to trigger faulty cargo fire alarms, things like that. It's a hard thing to quantify and say that there's a definite link, but there is something there, and until we can get the shielding exactly right, I don't think cell phones are going to be allowed. On the other hand, probably half of the people who fly don't bother to shut their phones off when they're supposed to, and really I think the airlines are shying away from letting people use their phones, not out of concerns over safety, but just the social aspect of it is so loaded. I mean, the idea of, you know, hundreds of people just sitting there for hours talking on their cell phones is almost, you know, too unbearable to imagine. But that's what would happen, and I think there's enough opposition to that where carriers just don't want to go there.
Thank you so much for calling us. My guest is Patrick Smith, a veteran pilot. His column, Ask the Pilot, appears regularly on Salon.com. This is WNYC. WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Jeff from Park Slope, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. I'm listening to this whole segment with great interest. I just flew this weekend. I fly a lot. And every time I get to an airport, what drives me crazy is actually not the process of flying. It's not as teeth-pulling as everyone likes to say it is or feel that it is, but the airlines could do so much by just improving the communications. When you walk in, you see a lot of inexperienced flyers not knowing where to go, not knowing what line to stand on. When you get to security, it's just this mass cloud of people who are just following the guy in front of them, not quite sure what to do. And then when you get to the gate, when they say, okay, it's time to board, and even though they call out by row section, again, there's this cloud of people that people don't know how to merge or get online. It just seems to me that they had a few more people on the floors, and unfortunately, the PA system sounds like subways also. You can't understand when they make public announcements. But just interacting with people and guiding them, people will go where they're led, but the airlines just seem to kind of let things happen haphazardly, and that's where the bottlenecks happen at every stage of the process.
You want to respond?
Yeah, those are good points. But it goes back to what I was saying a little while ago about airlines are just generally poor communicators, and they tend to be understaffed, and airports are crowded, and, you know, this is what we have to deal with, unfortunately.
Turbulence is something that often scares passengers, but don't you say that it's more a comfort issue than a safety issue?
Yeah, it's interesting to me because turbulence is far and away the number one concern of anxious flyers, and this is something I never realized until I started writing about air travel. From a pilot's point of view, turbulence is generally seen as a comfort and convenience issue, not as a safety issue.
How do pilots even know that there's going to be a problem? They always come over the loudspeaker and warn us that it's coming.
Well, predicting it is more of an art than a science sometimes. A lot of times you just don't know. And you know, pilots will change routings, change altitudes to avoid rough air, but it's not because they're worried about the wings falling off. They're just worried about the annoyance factor. I mean, nobody likes, you know, bumping through turbulence for an hour and a half, pilots included. You know, about 20 passengers every year are injured by turbulence in the United States.
That's out of 800 million, you said.
20 out of 800 million, and chances are it's because those people weren't belted in when they were supposed to be, and they break an ankle, hit a shoulder, something like that.
What about air traffic control? We've been hearing about problems in that system ever since Ronald Reagan was president.
Well, the air traffic control system is outdated. It needs to be modernized. It needs to be staffed better. It's got problems. A lot of people tend to equate the delays plague, flight delays plague, with the air traffic control system. That's not entirely fair. Yes, lots of flights are delayed. Airports get log jammed. It's better than it has been the past couple of summers nationwide, but it's, you know, still a big issue. Is this really an air traffic control thing? Not so much. It's more an airport's issue. I mean, you're only going to get so many planes in and out of an airport, regardless of how efficient the air traffic control system is. It becomes an airline scheduling issue, and some of the problem here is the major carriers' over-reliance on those aforementioned regional jets. You know, RJs now make up 50%, a whopping 50% of all the takeoffs and landings in this country. That sector of the industry has grown exponentially over the past 30 years. At some airports, like LaGuardia, you've got half or more of the traffic carrying 15 or 20% of the passengers. I mean, that's just not sustainable or efficient.
And then you have runway maintenance issues. At JFK, a runway has been closed for quite a while now.
It just recently reopened. And ironically, all the horrors that people were predicting when the runway was closed didn't really come to pass. Things ran a lot more smoothly than people expected. And most of the runway, almost all of it now, has been reopened.
But I've rarely had an experience where I got in a plane and we left on time. And it's usually because the pilot comes on and says, well, there are 20 planes ahead of us, and we're moving slowly, but we'll be up there soon.
Well, statistically, about 85% of scheduled flights do arrive on time. But that can vary, you know, with which airport you're flying out of. LaGuardia, Kennedy, Newark, tend to have more delays than average. Part of that, too, is the layout of these airports, especially Kennedy and LaGuardia, which were designed, you know, decades ago for just a fraction of the traffic that they now handle. You've got crisscrossing runways and crisscrossing taxiways, and, it's easy for things to become backlogged, especially at Kennedy in the late afternoon when you've got the big overseas departure push where you can have, 30 or more planes waiting in line to take off.
Maria, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. It's funny you should have been talking about turbulence because that ties in a little bit to my question. There was this horrible crash that took place off the coast of Brazil last year, and for people like me who fly, I guess, for pleasure and also because of work sometimes, but really don't enjoy it, especially because of the turbulence, that crash was just awful because it seemed like the plane had been in really bad weather for a while before it basically fell out of the sky or something horrible happened. And two things were talked about around that air crash, and that's what I'd like to ask your guest about. One is this issue of, I think, composites being used in more and more aircraft nowadays, and is that something we should be concerned about? Has that been tested, really thoroughly? But the other thing that's just surfaced recently that's been talked about in the papers is this issue that plane was so far out over the Atlantic, basically they weren't in contact with anyone, and stories in the New York Times have mentioned that, like, a lot of these flights going the polar route now are also in this kind of limbo for a period of time. And I just wanted to confirm, is that true? Because I never realized that. And honestly, that's really quite scary, too, to think that, you're just sort of flying out there with, completely untethered. So,
completely untethered is really the wrong way to look at it. I fly almost exclusively international transoceanic routes right now, so I'm used to this. There are large sectors of oceanic airspace where you are not in direct contact, live, real-time contact with air traffic control, but you're always in touch with your company dispatchers and air traffic control facilities, whether it's by HF radios or by digital data link on board in the cockpit. This gets complicated. To say that you are untethered and out of contact categorically is untrue. But it is a lot different than flying over controlled domestic airspace. In any case, that really has little or nothing to do with what might have happened to the Air France flight off Brazil. It's true the plane had strayed into an area apparently of really bad weather. How that played into what happened, we don't really know. It was a combination of things. It was nothing as simple as turbulence crashed the plane. I mean, that almost never happens. You know, there may have been an equipment malfunction. There was talk of certain air data sensors becoming iced over, and then that combined with the weather, combined with onboard computer failure, blah, 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 you know, eventually the plane crashed.
What about
the composites issue that the caller raised? This is another thing that we could talk about for a long time. But composites have been used in aircraft construction for many years now. And, you know, there's been a touch of controversy, you know, as far as certain parts of certain Airbus manufactured planes, you know, being made of composites. But, you know, at the end of the day, there are thousands of these planes flying. And, you know, we've seen, you know, one or two crashes over 20 years. I mean, to say that any of these planes is unsafe or unfit to fly is wrong.
New York has just killed thousands of Canadian geese. Are they a major problem for pilots?
They're not a major problem. You know, as the Hudson incident showed us, you know, planes and birds are not necessarily a good mix. But bird strikes are pretty common, and seldom, if ever, do we have a case like the U.S. Air.
I'm going to sneak one.
Sully upon Hudson.
I'm going to sneak one more caller in. You have to make this very quick. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Sally from Manhattan. I was a flight attendant for 36 years, and rather than me jumping out of an airplane, I wanted an eject button to get rid of unruly passengers.
I suspect you weren't the only flight attendant who felt that way. In fact, I'm sure that that's what Stephen Slater would have liked to have seen initially after that unruly passenger opened a gash in his forehead. Is this a problem for pilots as well, Patrick?
It can be. I mean, you know, all crew members are kind of in there together, and you know, occasionally pilots have to deal with unruly passengers as well. You know, looking at the bigger picture of what they call air rage, you know, on one hand, you know, we could argue that it's somewhat surprising that these things don't happen more often. I mean, if you've got 2 million people flying every day under stressful circumstances, it stands to reason that a certain number of them are going to become upset. You know, that's not justifying what they do or excusing it, but, you know, we should expect that. And some of these incidents tend to get overplayed and overspun in the media just because they involve air travel and airplanes, which, you know, automatically lifts whatever incident it is to a higher platform in the media. And, you know, that's not necessarily fair either.
Thank you so much for talking with us today, Patrick Smith, whose blog, Ask the Pilot, appears on Salon.com. It's been a pleasure.
Anytime.
And a lot of fun.
Thank you.